Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your presenter for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio and part of Faith Explored, where we help you to think through your faith wherever you're coming at it from, whether you're a believer or not. And today on the programme, we're going to be talking about near-death experiences and the curious case of Eben Alexander. I'll give you more details on that and the guests joining me for today's programme in a moment's time. If you're new to Unbelievable, this is the place where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk. Normally, we also do discussions between Christians of different theological perspectives, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback to last week's program. Now, we had a special podcast only edition of the show last week because we were doing some special fundraising activities on air, but we've had lots of response to that as well. Brian McLaren was joining me along with Andrew Wilson to talk about the Bible, and we will hear some of your feedback to that later on in today's program, as well as feedback to other recent editions of the programme. If you want to find out more about the programme, past episodes, subscribe to the podcast and see some of the comments underneath some recent shows, then do go to the all-new website for Unbelievable at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. It's a good place to go if you're interested in resources to help you explain and defend your faith or to interact with lots of different perspectives when it comes to the Christian worldview. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Also, a quick shout out to the RZIM, the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, based up in Oxford. They're putting on a special event in January. And if you want to find out more about that, look for Reasons for God happening in London at the end of January. It's going to be what looks like a fantastic lineup of speakers and a good place thing to get along to if you're interested in defending your faith. I'll give them a mention towards the end of today's programme as well. Well, today on the programme, we're not really focusing so much on issues between Christians and atheists and so on, but more something that's come into the public consciousness recently, especially because of a recent set of research that's been done called the AWARE studies. We're talking today about near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences. Let me explain. You're unbelievable. Well, today we're talking about the curious case of Eben Alexander. You may remember he joined me at the end of a programme several weeks ago talking about his near-death experience. Well, Eben is a neurosurgeon who documented a remarkable experience in his best-selling book Proof of Heaven. After contracting bacterial meningitis, he went into a coma and experienced an extraordinary journey in heaven, he thinks, that included beautiful valleys, waterfalls, flying on the wing of a butterfly, a guide alongside himself. And he says these experiences would have been impossible for his brain to produce in the state it was, the sort of flatline state it was during his coma. He says it is proof of the fact that we aren't simply neurochemicals and physical processes. There's a consciousness out there, and we need to be open to that. We're going to be hearing from Eben again in a moment's time. Also joining us on today's programme, our sceptic, if you like, is Jane Aspel. She's a neuroscientist at Anglia University. She's looked into the evidence for near-death experience and out-of-body experiences, and she remains sceptical that there's anything other than brain activity going on to produce these kinds of experiences. And we're going to be hearing why she believes that in the course of the programme. And it's a three-way conversation today. Graham Nichols has been undertaking personal research into out-of-body experiences, including his own, and we're going to be hearing about some of those in the course of the programme. He says there's lots of evidence from research. There's been the recent recent revelations of the AWARE project, that people have experienced and do experience objective facts about places, people and events that simply are beyond the physical space they're occupying, if you like. He's the author of a couple of books, including Avenues of the Human Spirit and Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience. So, Graham, we'll start with you. Thank you for coming on the programme today.
Great to be here.
So tell us about how you have an out-of-body experience. As I understand it, it's something you can kind of actually do and initiate yourself. Do you want to explain that?
My first experiences when I was around 12 years old were spontaneous, but then I basically started to research the subject around a year later when I heard about out-of-body experiences. And after around 6 months of trying, I was able to induce my very first out-of-body experience. And now, essentially, I can induce the experience when the conditions are right, is how I would describe it. It's basically, I usually feel some form of energy sensation or heightening of awareness. And when those signs are in place, then I can usually go into something akin to a deep meditation and I'll have an out-of-body experience. The degree to which I can control it, though, varies from experience to experience. The quality of vision, the quality of movement, all of those factors are variable within the experience.
Sure.
So it's something I've been exploring in depth using science, by taking part in experiments, organizing experiments in the US. And also I've developed technology, including immersive virtual reality structures to help induce these kinds of things.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, I can imagine some skeptics immediately thinking, sounds like a very eccentric mad professor doing psychic experiments. But for you, this is a real area of research and is yielding real results, isn't it? Do you want to very briefly explain what this AWARE project was that we heard the results of recently?
Well, the AWARE study was a four-year study where they were looking at not specifically near-death experiences, but if there is any kind of awareness during the resuscitation process. It's actually where the name comes from, AW for awareness and RE for resuscitation.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't produce maybe the results that people were hoping for, but it definitely produced some interesting results suggesting that awareness after cardiac arrest is possible. Well, one case, for example, where it was able to time when the out-of-body experience component of what happened took place, because there was a sound that was timed to exactly 3 minutes going off within the operating theatre. So they were able to know that person was flatlined or was perceiving during their cardiac arrest for around 3 minutes. That was an interesting piece of data, but there are many other studies.
Sure.
Pim van Lommel's research in the Netherlands, Penny Sartori's in the UK. There's many, many different studies that all show the same kinds of things,
same kind of thing.
That people can perceive things while out of body.
Tell us about an example of your own, where you've had an out-of-body experience, which hasn't just been a dream, if you like, but where you can say, I saw something, experienced something, which I was then later able to verify as true.
Well, I've had many over the years. One fairly recent one took place where I went to a cathedral called the Alexander Nevsky Cathedral, which is in Tallinn, Estonia, where I spend a lot of my time. In the out-of-body experience, I drifted over the roof of the cathedral and down to the far side, which can only be seen if you are literally on that side of the building. So it can't be seen from any other part of the city. And I was able to perceive that there was tarpaulin and tape and structural damage to one of the windows on the right-hand side of the doorway. I was able to perceive all of those details. When I came back to my body, we made detailed notes of what I'd perceived during the out-of-body experience, including the tape, the tarpaulin, the location on the building, etc. My partner took all these details down, and I then went to the building, took a photograph of as the how the building looked. It matched in every detail with what I'd seen in the out-of-body experience. Now, that's one example of many throughout my life that was both verified, and I've actually had up to four witnesses in the room at the time of my out-of-body experience who confirm what I've seen. There's videos online if people are interested in watching witnesses talking about confirming what I saw.
Mm. Okay, fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme today, Graham. Well, we'll hear shortly from our sceptical voice on the show today, Jane Aspel of Anglia Ruskin University. She's a lecturer in cognitive science and psychology. But first of all, welcome along to the programme, Eben Alexander. Do you want to just give, again, a very brief thumbnail sketch of what you told me on the programme a few weeks ago about this this experience you had? You had what's called bacterial meningitis. You went into a coma and you experienced this extraordinary journey, which you go into great detail in Proof of Heaven. For you, all of this was impossible as far as the kind of state that your brain was in during that time, as far as being able to have these very vivid experiences.
Yes, I came down with a severe gram-negative bacterial meningitis that drove me into coma, grand mal seizures and coma, within about 3.5 hours. And that in itself puts you at about a 10% chance of survival. And my doctors knew from my neurologic exams, from my MR and CT scans, from my lab values, that this was a very severe case that involved my entire neocortex, all 8 lobes of my brain impacted by this, with really a full thickness effect on my neocortex. And, of course, that's what was such a mystery when I was trying to resolve all this when I came out of it, was how in the world did this experience happen? My doctors assured me that I could not have had any experience. In fact, by the end of that week, I was down to a 2% chance of survival, no chance of recovery, and they were saying best case scenario, if you know, with that 2% chance, was that I'd spend months in coma and then finally die. That's when why they recommended stopping antibiotics. Now, the most important thing is that deep in the middle of this, as I explain in great detail in Proof of Heaven, I had this extraordinary spiritual journey of ultra reality and encountering beings that only made sense much later to realize, you know, people who've read Proof of Heaven will realize the nature of the revelation about some of the beings that I encountered in that journey. And that was what I was faced with in the months after my experience, was trying to explain it. Originally, I thought it had to be some kind of hallucination or drug effect or dream state or confabulation. And yet everywhere I turned and discussing it with my doctors and reviewing all my medical records, we could find no way for that to have occurred in my brain, given our modern understanding of the neocortex and its role in consciousness.
And so at some level, you believe you experienced a realm beyond the, you know, the physical realm. You experienced a heavenly state or some kind of out-of-body near-death experience that was not located simply in what was going on in your brain.
Right, and it's important to point out the multiple realms that I passed through. The first was what I call Earthworm's Eye View, a very primitive, coarse, unresponsive realm. And in looking back on it, I think that was the very best consciousness that my physical brain could muster, soaking in pus. But that then led into several other very enhanced, ultra-real, vivid, alive realms of Gateway Valley, all the way up to the core outside of all time and space, where there was really an extraordinary sense. I mean, it makes this world look very murky and dreamlike by comparison,
which is
tough part.
Yeah, and that's a common, I think, description of people who have had these kinds of experiences. And we will hear again in a moment from Graham Nichols about out-of-body experiences that he's had and he's had documentation of. Let's talk, first of all, though, to Jane Aspel, neuroscientist. Jane, thank you for coming on the line. Do you want to just give us a brief background as to how you got into investigating these kinds of issues of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences?
Well, my research really focuses on how the brain creates a sense of self. And so I tend to usually do experiments where I try and manipulate somebody's self-consciousness in the lab, somebody who's just a healthy person off the street. But to understand self-consciousness, it's also useful to look at people who've had alterations in self-consciousness, and an out-of-body experience is one example of that, where people perceive their self and their body to be in different places. So by looking at these patients, you can start to understand how it is that the brain creates the sense of self, which is normally seemed to be located in your body.
Mm.
So if you see what part of the brain is perhaps not functioning properly in these patients, that might tell you the part of the brain which is functioning properly in healthy people to create our ordinary sort of sense of self. So I guess that's why there's that link with my research.
Sure. And when it comes down to it, are you convinced from the research you've done that any experience that is related, whether it be out-of-body, near-death experience like we heard from Eben, that it is actually going on in the brain, even if it seems extraordinary and ultra real, as Eben describes it?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be open-minded, obviously, not to sort of close your mind to things. But, as scientists, we just try as hard as we can to provide a naturalistic, scientific explanation of things, which doesn't involve, violations of physics or having to invoke things which are not matter, like souls.
So a supernatural explanation is not, as far as you're concerned, a scientific
explanation? No, I think you need to try as hard as you possibly can to provide a natural explanation, and I don't think the natural explanations have failed so far, so I would advocate,
What would you say then? I mean, I know, Eben, that you, as far as you're concerned, there is not a, in that sense, natural explanation to what occurred for you, because as far as you're concerned, the bits of the brain that could have produced that were not functioning. Is that correct?
Well, I would say that, putting the label supernatural on it, in a sense, is very misleading, because okay. it kind of presumes what we know to be natural and then what is beyond the realm of natural. But I think the important thing, and this is where I believe a lot of neuroscience is headed at this point, is realizing that to look at the brain as creating consciousness is the big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, I would say the models that are emerging now that, in my view, hold a lot more promise are models that basically look at the brain as a reducing valve or filter that limits pre-existing consciousness down to this little trickle of our awareness. And there are just an overwhelming amount of evidence about non-local consciousness, about knowing things beyond the ken of our physical senses, that is undeniable. And for the scientists out there who are interested, I steer them to the book Irreducible Mind, Toward a Psychology for the 21st Century, and that group from University of Virginia is putting out a sequel to that in February 2015.
What's your response to that view then, Jane?
Well, I mean, obviously we haven't got much time, so we can't discuss all possible examples of these non-local consciousness phenomena, but just thinking about Dr. Alexander's particular experience, what I would want to know is how he knew that consciousness that he was having was occurring at the time that his brain was in that state. So how could he sort of put a time mark, a time stamp on when that conscious experience was occurring? So he's saying that, convincingly his brain was sort of full of pus in that sort of nice description of it. It was very inflamed, I guess, and not capable of producing any kind of cortical activity. But how do we know that those experiences that he had were occurring at that time and weren't occurring, say, at some time before his brain deteriorated a lot?
Or as he was coming out of the coma or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the crucial thing to know, really.
I mean, and in your view, a brain can produce extraordinary experiences even as it's shutting down or as it's waking up again. Would that be the view?
Yeah.
Just a quick response, Eben, before we talk
to Graham. Basically, I assumed that was the case initially. I thought, well, this had to happen, as I was going into coma or coming out. But I go into great detail in Proof of Heaven, especially because of some of the evidence, the faces I saw coming out, for example, the six faces at the very end of the journey, that showed me very clearly that the vast majority of my experience had to happen between days 1 and 5 of my 7-day coma. And that's all explained in Proof of Heaven about how that is the case.
Graham, you've had these out-of-body experiences yourself then, but for you it's more than just these are amazing experiences. You believe in what you've called the veridical nature of these experiences, that you can experience things, places, facts that weren't open to you just, you know, in your physical bodily presence, but and so on. So is this for you an example of something that cannot be explained naturalistically in that sense, in the way that Jane suggests we can account for most experiences?
Okay, well, I do think that they're a natural experience. I don't subscribe to a supernatural perspective. But I started off from quite a skeptical understanding myself. And when I had my initial experiences, which started when I was quite young, I didn't really know what to consider them, whether they were hallucinations, some form of dream, although I was never asleep when they happened. Didn't really know what they were. But as I had increasing numbers of experiences, I started to find that many elements of them would conform with objective reality. The first significant example of that was I was able to go into a building through an out-of-body experience. I was several kilometers from where I lived, and I was able to perceive details of the person who lived there. There was office stationery laid out on a desk, paperwork from a business, letterhead paper. I wasn't able to perceive everything in detail, but I was able to perceive the name of the person who lived there at the top of the letterhead. And also en route to the building, I was also able to see West 11 on one of the signs next to the street. Mm.
All things that you might be able to ascribe to a dream, say, you know, you might see these details very clearly and even remember them possibly on waking. Presumably, there was a way in which you were then able to go and check this out, and you discovered that everything did correspond to what you had seen in this experience?
Yes. Well, I looked up the name and address in the Yellow Pages. This is pre-internet days.
Right.
And then I also retraced the route. The name and postcode matched with what I'd seen in the experience. And then I was able to retrace the route and find that it did actually exist as I'd seen it in the experience. That was just the first of many experiences.
Yeah.
And
I've
since had experiences with
sure.
up to four people present when I had the out-of-body experience. So all of the details were given beforehand.
I'd just be interested then, Jane, to hear what your response is to that extraordinary story. You presumably have heard similar sorts of stories as well in the course of the research you've done. Is there any way of explaining it?
Well, it's an extraordinary story, and not to, you know, be patronising or just to disbelieve people, but, you know, for such an extraordinary claim, we'd have to have extraordinary evidence, wouldn't we? And we can't just go, unfortunately, by Graham's word or by the word of the people who were there. We'd have to have a controlled experiment where mm-hmm. we could be really sure that Graham's mind was able to leave his body, go to another location, see some information there that he couldn't possibly have seen, and then really verify that that's happened. And if we could do those things, then, you know, that would be incredible, and that mm-hmm. would be a huge revolution in science. But that has never happened.
So as far as you're concerned, this is anecdotal.
Yes, that's the problem.
Yeah, okay. Graham, what's your response to that?
Well, actually, I think we have a lot more than that, because I think in every single prospective near-death experience study that's been conducted, there's been cases of veridical evidence of people seeing things whilst out of body during those prospective studies. So we're not talking there about a case of someone with witnesses, although I still think that's completely valid, but we're talking about prospective studies. Then we go to research like remote viewing research, which even skeptics like Ray Hyman have admitted they had no ready explanation for. There's tons of evidence within that kind of research that really supports the idea of non-local perception. There's books like Eben mentioned, Irreducible Mind, that go into great lengths. It's a very, very extensive book.
This idea, though, that James put forward, though, is that we need sort of testable experiments. So at one level, it's all very well to have stories and so on, but I guess you can always cast doubt on those if they're not done under, if you like, laboratory conditions.
We're talking about experiments. I talked about the parapsychological experiments, which are done under controlled conditions. And then we're talking about near-death prospective studies. You can't obviously have someone have a cardiac arrest in an experiment, in a pre-designed experiment.
Well, there but what is you one can experiment do, in Southampton where they have put, I'm sure you know about it, Graham, where they've put these cards with pictures on very high up in the room of an accident and emergency room, sort of on shelves, which you can't possibly see if you just walk into the room, to see if when someone does have a cardiac arrest and has an out-of-body experience, if they really are going up to the ceiling and they should be able to see what those cards are and report back on them.
And that's never produced any positive results?
No. So whenever these very controlled conditions are set up,
they
strangely,
fail to produce.
The positive results never, you know.
Just quickly a response, Graham, and then I must bring Eben back into the conversation.
Jane is referring to the AWARE study, and in that particular study, which has just been released, the data shows that there was simply not enough cases, which can't be put down to problem with the out-body experiences or a problem with the research. It was simply that there were not enough instances of out-body experiences to really establish anything in terms of the data. But what they did establish was that in the veridical case that was found in that particular study, that there was evidence of continuation of consciousness after cardiac arrest, which has been consistent, as I said, throughout all the studies. Pim van Lommel's, Penny Sartori's. Penny Sartori found examples of perceptions that could not have been gained in any other way. So did a researcher at Keene University in the US, found a 12-digit number that the woman was able to remember while out of body. This was done by a researcher again. So when you look at, there's so many cases and there's so much data, I think it's ridiculous to just say that, there isn't any evidence.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll return for part two, in which we'll hear from, again, Eben and Jane Aspel. And if you're interested in getting in touch about today's programme, then feel free to do so by emailing me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also follow on Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to interact on the Facebook page. And all of those details available from the website of the programme. That's premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Look forward to hearing what you have to say about near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences. And we'll be continuing the conversation in just a moment's time here on Unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we uncover the scandal of Christmas, why a story about a couple in poverty, low-life shepherds, and claims of a virgin birth still have the ring of truth today. Plus, unlikely singing sensation Susan Boyle talks to us about faith and fame. We ask, where is God in Downton Abbey? And we celebrate the extraordinary legacy of Billy Graham. All that, plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Hello, welcome back to Unbelievable. This Saturday afternoon, the second part of today's programme, looking at near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences and more, in the company of Eben Alexander and Jane Aspel. Returning to that conversation in just a moment's time. Unbelievable tries to bring you interesting discussions every week, and we had a really interesting one last week, which was a podcast special between Andrew Wilson and Brian McLaren. We're going to be talking about some of the responses to that. Lots of people, including atheists, interestingly, given it was a sort of inter-Christian exchange, saying how good they found that, respectful dialogue and so on. And also lots of response still to the Christianity on Trial episode of a couple of weeks ago now, when US trial lawyer Mark Lanier was interacting with ex-Christian Paul Beaumont. So listen out for that later on in today's programme. Right now, it's time to rejoin this discussion. And we've been hearing in the last section from Graham Nichols, who has himself had lots of evidence, as he sees it, for out-of-body experiences and their veracity. Let's get back into talking about this with our other guests today, Jane Aspel of Anglia Ruskin University, a lecturer in cognitive science and psychology, and Eben Alexander, the author of Proof of Heaven and, more recently, The Map of Heaven. Eben, you've obviously looked into these areas as well, and presumably you overall agree with where Graham is coming from on this.
Well, I do, and I would say that what happens here is we're seeing that materialist neuroscientists that believe that the brain creates consciousness, the more we learn about the brain and the more this whole world advances on this front, the more we realize that there is overwhelming evidence that the brain does not create consciousness, that the reality behind remote viewing, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, shared death experiences where the soul of a bystander gets sucked along even to the point of seeing life or view, the whole host of millions and millions of examples of non-local consciousness is completely overwhelming the kind of minuscule efforts of materialist science to pretend that consciousness is created by the brain and that these events are not happening. That's why Irreducible Mind is a very important book. It's a dense 800 pages of hardcore science data analysis that goes all into non-local consciousness. And there's no way to go through that tremendous body of evidence and come away from it thinking that there's nothing to it.
Sure.
Nobody could possibly conclude there's nothing to it.
I don't know if you've had an opportunity to read the book in question, Jane, but from what everything they're saying, it's overwhelming. There's so much evidence out
well,
there.
Well, as I'm saying, it's the quality of the evidence, though. Again, it's not under the conditions that a scientist would require. And the AWARE study that Graham said more about, I mean, in that, the one that was published recently in the Resuscitation Journal, there was one single patient of which they believe they could... So there were quite a few patients who had cardiac arrest, said they'd had consciousness, you know, after they were dead. But again, it's the same problem as for Eben, is being sure that that consciousness happened while they were dead. And there was only one person out of all of the patients in that published study who apparently you could sort of timestamp his experience. But, you know, even that is not clear. It could have been, how was it timestamped? Because there was a machine whirring in the room, but the machine could be whirring, you know, every 5 minutes. So there are explanations. I think the problem is if you want to believe in them, then they're sort of convincing.
But couldn't someone turn around to you, Jane, and say...
a skeptical enough mind and try hard enough to find the naturalistic scientific explanation.
I mean, could someone turn around and say, well, maybe you and other sceptics don't want to believe in them equally? I don't know.
I'd love to believe in life after death. I mean, I really do not want myself, you know, my soul to end. I wish someone could find this evidence. But until they do, then, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm not going to believe it until I find the evidence. But I would love somebody to find that evidence.
Okay, Eben, what did you want to say?
Yeah. What I recommend is, as a scientist, first of all, I think if you read Proof of Heaven, I wrote that book for scientists, for skeptics. And then Map of Heaven is a great extension beyond that. I will also say that, you know, as I mentioned, Irreducible Mind is an incredibly good scientific book on every bit of this. And there's a sequel to that book that will come out February 2015 from University of Virginia, and it is called Beyond Physicalism, Toward a Reconciliation of Science and Spirituality. Anyone who studies consciousness deeply gets very into all of the evidence that we have at hand, really comes away seeing that materialist science saying that the brain creates consciousness is a faith-based religion that actually has less to support it than the views that recognize that consciousness, soul, spirit, is fundamental in the universe. And that is where the science is headed, is to that recognition.
Jane?
I go to the Association of the Scientific Study of Consciousness meeting, which is the biggest meeting that they have every year, and I really don't think the science of consciousness is headed in the direction that Eben
says it is.
Well, a big problem is if you ask that materialist scientific community, how does the physical brain create consciousness, you know, get into the hard problem of consciousness, you really come up with nothing. There's nothing there. That's why I say it is a faith-based religion. There's this incredible belief, which I used to believe. I mean, I know where you're coming from, that the brain creates consciousness, and yet no one has the remotest clue how. And I would say the more we study the brain and the more we study the evidence of these extraordinary phenomena of non-local consciousness, the more we realize that the brain does not produce consciousness at all.
And so in a sense, the brain is a conduit, if you like, a channeling of consciousness that is not produced by it. I mean, presumably your view, Jane, is that the brain is the source of consciousness and that therefore consciousness is ultimately reducible to neuron activity, to the processes of the brain.
Yeah, I mean, all we can show really is that, you know, whenever a certain conscious brain, conscious mental state occurs, there is this corresponding physical neural state. So, you know, we're looking at correlations, really. I mean, there is, I admit, a philosophical problem at a deep level when you think about it, in that sense, when you think about conscious states and, you know, the quality of a feeling or a thought or a desire or whatever, you know, how can that be the same as neurons firing? And that is, something
of a
mystery,
a
but
mystery,
I don't think, we have to keep going with the science. We can't just reach out to these explanations that don't bear any relation to centuries of science.
I suppose it depends on what you count as a valid explanation in science, and obviously Eben and Graham believe that the explanations go beyond just the physical explanations. You've been hearing some of this conversation going on between Eben and Jane there, Graham. What's your take on all of this? Do you also subscribe to Eben's view that consciousness is something that, as it were, is not produced by the brain, but is something that, in some sense, is out there, and the brain at some level is actually just grabbing onto and filtering towards us?
I'm aware of the particular perspective that Eben's putting across. I don't know what the solution or the answer is at this point. I'm interested in all the possible explanations. For example, the orchestrated objective reduction theory put forward by Roger Penrose is very interesting to me, because I think it might well be something to do with quantum biology, what's going on. And that's what the sort of idea that he's putting forward, that basically there might be at very, very low levels in the brain, and there is more and more data supporting this. For example, a study at the University of Milan a couple of years ago showed that there was entanglement taking place between neurons. So essentially, his idea is that the microtubules, the very, very low-level structures of the brain, could be entangled in some way, and that these processes are actually how information can be passed, developed, and built up into some form of consciousness.
In that sense, you're still trying to give a scientific, you could say natural, explanation for what is an extraordinary phenomenon, because you've said already you don't believe in that sense in a supernatural realm. You would seek to find a natural explanation, but one that maybe pushes the boundaries of what we know as science.
Sure, I'm just going by the data. I mean, from my perspective, the skeptical understanding is incomplete because they're simply ignoring the veridical elements that come through.
Jane, from Graham's perspective, we need to expand our horizons as to the kind of scientific explanations we could bring to these kinds of experiences. Is that a valid response to you?
Well, I mean, the Roger Penrose thing, he's trying to bring in quantum physics to explain neurobiology, which I think is, there's not many neuroscientists who would go along with that. I mean, microtubules are in every single cell of every body, and they're not just in neurons. I mean, that explanation doesn't make very much sense, and I don't know how that would really help explain Graham's consciousness moving, physically from one place to another. It's just one kind of fantastical theory to explain some fantastical evidence. So again, it's not that we're ignoring the data. Again, if we had good data from a controlled experiment, then absolutely we'd have to take it on board and try and explain it. But to my mind, there hasn't been any great, well-controlled experiment which has shown the kind of thing that Graham says happens to really happen.
Eben, bringing you back in, there simply isn't any controlled experiment. I mean, That's the claim that Jane's putting out
there.
Well,
I would say, you know, in the search for truth, and especially the deepest secrets of the universe, yes, it's great if we can use our scientific method to help explain things, but we, you know, we're not always going to have the luxury of having a nice, clean, neat and tidy, randomly controlled, double-blinded study to prove this stuff to us. So we have to take a lot of the evidence that the universe presents to us, and I think that is where, you know, some people can really get lost down in the weeds through the myopia of very limited reductive materialist scientific methodology to miss some of the deeper truths of the universe. And it's one of the reasons why our current neuroscience in trying to explain consciousness has hit such an absolute wall in terms of their understanding of, you know, with this idea that the physical workings of the brain explain everything that occurs in human conscious experience, because it does not.
Mm.
And in fact, this is why I think the science is definitely opening up to this.
Can you give an example?
I'm sorry, what?
Could you give an example of something that it's not explaining?
Oh, my God. The 800 pages of evidence about remote viewing, about out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, past-life memories in children, shared death experiences, precognition, presentiment. I mean, there's a gigantic world of non-local consciousness. Irreducible Mind is a great starting point. The books of Dean Radin.
I mean, what about giving us one specific example, Eben, that maybe we can just toss around with us for a few minutes so that Jane could...
I would
say
my experience deep in coma has zero to explain it from the modern neuroscientific view of brain creates consciousness.
Well,
if
my
you
explanation
think that
would be that you were having consciousness at a time when your brain was functioning, but it somehow it appeared to you that that was happening at the time when your brain wasn't functioning. How can you prove...
The evidence is there in proof of heaven that it all had to happen between days 1 and 5.
Just quickly explain, also, if you can, very quickly, because obviously what Jane's searching for is why do you how can you be sure that these experiences occurred during the time your brain was effectively flatlining and not just before or just after or whenever.
So well, can you
briefly explain that?
This...
Go ahead.
As I describe in the book Proof of Heaven, it was the way things laid out, especially the appearance of six faces at the very end, five of whom were physically there in the last 18 hours of coma. And notably, many friends and family who were there prior to that time did not appear to me, but there was also a woman who appeared to me who was not physically there, and she was coming to me from Chapel Hill. This is all explained in detail in the book.
Sure.
But it very clearly lays out that the vast majority of this coma journey had to happen between days 1 and 5, not when I came out. Now, of great note is also that, as I describe, in the 36 hours after I came out of coma, after the breathing tube was removed, and after I started coming back to this world, I was in and out of a very psychotic nightmare, a paranoid delusional nightmare as my brain was trying to get back online. That was completely different from the ultra-real experience that happened deep in coma. Also very interesting is the fact that the memories from deep in coma, from those multiple realms that I traversed, those memories are as sharp today as if they happened yesterday. This all happened 6 years ago. And the memories from the psychotic nightmare, which I believe were a very brain-based phenomenon, faded within weeks. And this is a very common scenario in thousands of other near-death experiences.
Okay,
ultra-reality.
I think that gives
effect.
Us some things for Jane to respond to there. So, Jane, I guess, okay, we haven't got time to spell out exactly how these faces could be time-stamped in a sense, but obviously Eben believes that there is good reason for seeing that things happened within the course of his brain dead, if you like, or flatlined experience. And then there's this kind of, you know, ultra real, crisp today as the day he had it experience that does not is not the same as any other kind of memory or brain experience he has.
Yeah, well, I think near-death experiences are extraordinarily salient and real and vivid, and, you know, I've never had one, so I can't... but, you know, from everyone I've spoken to, they are such vivid, incredible things, and so I can understand why that would change your worldview and that it would make you really convinced in something. But, you know, the fact that you remember that very well, that doesn't go against consciousness being generated by the brain.
Can you give any explanation why a near-death experience or out-of-body experience would have this incredibly vivid aspect to it?
Well, you tend to remember things which are very emotionally arousing, for a start. You know, you tend to remember things that are very salient in your life, like, you know, an accident or getting married or, you know, something like that. So just the emotional arousal in itself would probably mean that it would be remembered better than something much more mundane, like brushing your teeth in the morning. So I don't really think that part is kind of evidence for it. I mean, the thing about the six faces, that seems to be the most crucial thing. Presumably they are faces of people who are close to Eben, so people he'd expect to be there. I know there were other possible people who he could have seen, but he didn't see.
Can I just check then, Eben, with these faces, were these people who came to your bedside at certain points which corresponded with points in the experience you had?
Well, five of them were there those last 18 hours, as I said, and that and they were at the very end of the coma experience. So that pretty clearly to me, especially because of the timing details that I go into in the book, they showed me that all the coma experience had to happen between days one and five.
Mm.
And the interesting thing, and the reason it was so striking to me and compelled me to delve deeply into an understanding of this, is the fact that my doctors reassured me from the get-go, because they knew that my gray-white junction was blurred at the very base of my neocortex through all eight lobes of my brain, that all the sulci were filled with pus. My entire cortex was very edematous. They knew from my neurologic exams that I had no neocortical activity beyond the first hour or so of hitting the emergency room. My brain stem was badly damaged. This was a horrific case of gram-negative bacterial meningoencephalitis, damaging my brain stem even from the first day. And any doctor who takes care of such patients will tell you there really is no explanation, for one thing, for my recovery. To fully recover within eight weeks is a real medical miracle. And to have had any experience at all in there, I mean, if you believe that the neocortex participates in detailed conscious awareness in humans, then what in the world do we, how do we explain all this, given the fact that my neocortex was so clearly damaged all over, not just in one little region, but the entire neocortex was affected by this, and the ultra reality of it goes far beyond the ability of my brain, even now perfectly healthy, to duplicate.
Jane, any responses? It is interesting, this fact that the neocortex was damaged in such a way that as far as Eben's concerned, it couldn't have produced those experiences.
Yeah, it seems unlikely that they could have happened at that time. So, again, my explanation would be that somehow that conscious experience was happening either before or after.
And the fact he saw
the brain that somehow recovered a bit. And
these faces
the
was a coincidence in some way?
Sorry, and for the six faces, that perhaps somehow the information of those people being there at that time had somehow got through to his brain and then had somehow become part of
the
that
experience.
Conscious experience, which had then occurred when the brain had recovered enough to support that kind of activity. Because, you know, his neurons didn't actually die, because when neurons die, they don't recover.
Mm.
And we don't know, you know, at the very limits of brain function, that maybe, you know, a voice, a touch, somehow the information of who was there
could be transferred,
could have got through, could have been stored, could have then been incorporated,
could have been
in
incorporated
a conscious experience
later.
That happened after.
Sure. I've got you.
Yeah.
Graham, you've been listening along to the way that Jane sees it. Anything you'd want to bring into this conversation?
Well, I just think, as I mentioned, there's Eben's case is an excellent case among many, and I think there are, you know, it's the veridical factors that, in my experience and in my understanding, that kind of convince me. I mean, in my book, Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience, I devoted a whole chapter to looking at the skeptical explanations and exploring different ideas like lack of oxygen, hypoxia, apoxia, you know, different arguments that are put forward. And the problem is regardless of, you know, when the actual experience took place, people are perceiving things sometimes in completely separate rooms and different parts of buildings that they just could not have perceived from any normal sensory form.
But without me even bringing in Jane at this point, I know that she's going to say, show me the rigorous experiment. Show me, you know, where that's been shown. This is anecdotal.
Well, they are rigorous. They've been undertaken by Pim van Lommel, who did the largest ever study on the subject. In terms of near-death experience research, Pim van Lommel, Penny Sartori, she looked at, for example, with the idea of lack of oxygen in the brain, she looked at oxygen levels in the people who had the near-death experience. She looked at drug levels to see if that could explain what happened. And still she found veridical supporting data within her study, which had far more interesting cases actually than the AWARE studies. But obviously those things come down to chance to some degree, whether someone dies and has a particular experience or gets close to death at least. Pim van Lommel's case, there was a famous case within that study that was all recorded at the time, moments after the experience occurred, where the man who'd had the cardiac arrest was able to perceive his dentures being removed and where they were placed and by who he'd never actually seen this individual because he came into the hospital already in a coma, and then he had a cardiac arrest. At that point, his dentures were removed, etc. So all of that information was recorded on site within moments. These are the most controlled studies of near-death experiences that could possibly be done. Because obviously, as I mentioned earlier, you can't put someone into a lab and ask them to have
a near-death
these
experience.
Kinds of experiences on tap.
Well, Jane, just before you have to leave us, and thank you for being with us on the programme today, some things you can't replicate in the laboratory.
I know I'm asking a lot. You know, you'd need somebody who could, I suppose, have an OB at will. I mean, I think there are some people like that. And obviously you can't, you know, stop somebody's heart when you feel like it. But as I said, it's extraordinary claims, so you need extraordinary evidence, really, to believe something which goes against, you know, centuries of scientific evidence, the fact that we don't know that anything exists apart from physical matter. So, you know, to overthrow centuries worth of science, we need to have some really solid evidence. And there are ways of explaining the things that Graham mentions about, you know, the dentures being pulled out and things like that. And we don't know enough about what happens to the brain at the point where oxygen levels are very low, where it's damaged in some way. You know, we don't know quite what it's capable of. So we're kind of assuming that at that point, you know, when oxygen has stopped, the brain has completely stopped functioning. But we don't know that for sure. And for example, recently there was a study with rats where they induced cardiac arrest in them, and they showed that there was this sudden flare of activity in the gamma frequency, which occurred just after the cardiac arrest. So, you know, there's something strange that might happen to the brain in those situations, which might enable memory encoding or who knows what. So it's still possible to explain some of these things, again, in a naturalistic way, you know, using what we know about matter, about biology, without having to reach for explanations of consciousness being some kind of immaterial substance.
Graham, you say, you've heard Jane saying there, we've got centuries of science that show only natural physical explanations for things. We shouldn't overthrow that just because there's a number of people saying something happened while I was in a cardiac arrest and so on. It's not strong enough as far as she's concerned.
Well, I think that's a jump to say that we need to overthrow everything. I think the scientists that I've mentioned, Brian Josephson, Nobel laureate in physics, Pim van Lommel, you know, Roger Penrose, all of these people I've mentioned, they're not claiming that we need to overthrow science. They're claiming that possibly these things could be explained by different mechanisms like quantum effects, etc., by quantum biology. You know, Jane is not explaining them either. She's just putting forward, oh, it could have been this, it could have been that. But that's not proving anything. That's just doing exactly what, you know, what I'm doing in terms of theoretical models. I'm just saying, you know, it could be this in terms of the models. I don't know which model is correct and which is incorrect. I'm just putting forward these possibilities. But when it comes to the actual data, like the research, like the studies that these scientists have done, I don't think you can just dismiss them and say, oh, they could have been this or they could have been that, or they're not rigorous enough. Because I think, as I said, you know, I would like to hear how they could be more rigorous. And to say that there is no research in the hundreds of years of science, I think actually we have 115 years, nearly 135 years or so of parapsychological data, which Dean Radin, who I have also done experiments with, showed that there's a level of seven sigma statistical significance to the data supporting psi abilities. Now, that's a huge level. That's more than the Higgs boson data. So when you think about it in that context, we're not really talking about something that's wishy-washy data. We're talking about something that's got a huge body supporting it.
We're going to have to let you go, I know, Jane, now, but thanks for being on the programme. Anything you want to say just as you leave us?
Yeah, well, I guess just having very high statistical significance in itself doesn't mean anything, because you need to look at how the experiment was actually conducted. And whenever parapsychology experiments are conducted in very controlled experiments where, you know, there's no possibility for a psychic or whatever to know what's going on in another room, they aren't able to come up with the goods. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to just be, you know, pouring cold water on things, but as I said...
You're the cold rationalist in this programme, aren't you, Jane?
I'd love to believe, you know, that we don't die when our brains stop functioning, but I've yet to find any great evidence.
Compelling evidence is what you're after. Yeah. But would you be willing, if you saw the evidence, as far as you're concerned, to investigate alternative explanations to purely... physical ones?
Well, we'd have to, yeah. I mean, if that was really shown to happen, we'd have to. You know, science can't just rule things out just for the sake of it, or just, you know, because we don't want to believe in supernatural things or whatever, but you have to go along with what the evidence says. So,
and the best explanation, as far as you're concerned at present, is still the physical one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us on the programme today, Jane.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great.
All the very best. If people want to find out more about you, they can find about you at the University of Anglia website, can they?
Yeah.
Great stuff. A little page there.
Research page, yeah.
Great. Thanks very much and all the very best.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a quick break, and then Graham Nichols and Eben Alexander are with me just for a final few minutes as we start to wrap up today's conversation. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent programmes. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon. It's the time of the week here on Premier Christian Radio when we try to shift your brain into fifth gear with some interesting conversations with people from across the spectrum. Very often Christian, non-Christian debates. Today a bit different, really, because we're looking at an unusual area, out-of-body and near-death experiences, in the company of two people who are definite believers in it and one person who definitely hasn't been a believer in it. And we're going to be concluding that conversation in just a moment. If you're the type of person who enjoys reading and engaging with different perspectives on the Christian, in the Christian marketplace, with engaging with culture, that kind of thing, can I recommend Christianity Magazine, or Premier Christianity Magazine as it's become more recently known? I'm the editor of the magazine, and you can find a variety of the interviews and features that we have from the magazine on the website, premierchristianity.com. You can ask for a free sample by going to the free sample tab on the website as well. And many people have been subscribing in the past year, and it's encouraging to hear your positive feedback. Some of the stuff we cover on Unbelievable on a regular basis makes it into the pages of the magazine, especially in the realm of apologetics. Now, we heard last week, or at least via the podcast, the discussions between Brian McLaren and Andrew Wilson, Brian McLaren, if you like, in the progressive camp, Andrew Wilson in the more evangelical camp, when it comes to how we should interpret scripture. Are we open to rethinking and kind of adding to, in a sense, to the conversation of scripture? And we've got videos of that online, and we've also got their articles coming out in the forthcoming edition of the magazine. That's the January edition, landing towards the middle of December. So that's a good edition to get your hands on if you're interested in reading more on this subject. PremierChristianity.com if you want to find out more about it. Don't forget, you can find more conversations such as today's on the Unbelievable webpage as well. You can find links to the Unbelievable Conference DVD and audio CD as well if you want to listen to some 13 hours or more of material from this year's conference at Westminster Central Hall. Then there's a link to that from the webpage as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Okay, what's coming up next week on the programme? If you come back, same time, same place, real special treat for you next week. We've got Keith Ward, who's the former Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, a philosopher, and he's a Christian, and he's written a new book called The Evidence for God, and it's really various ways in which he believes we find evidence for God through our experience of the world, of our mind, from science and so on. And he's going to be in conversation with Michael Roos, who's an atheist philosopher. He's got a new book out called Atheism, What Everyone Needs to Know. So a definitive book on both sides by these guys. But what's great about them is they just have fantastic conversations when they get together. So you'll want to listen to that. You may remember they joined me over a year ago. And that was such an interesting conversation between them, because it's very amicable, jocular, a great way of interacting. And I think you'll find the same for next week's programme. So join me for that as they debate the evidence for God next week. Later on today, if you can stick around for the rest of Faith Explored, on the profile, we'll be hearing from Lucinda van der Hart as she interacts with, firstly, Tom Herbert, who is from the Fabulous Baking Brothers, talking about his Christian faith and a recent trip he had to Laos with his young son Milo on behalf of Tear Fund. And then Roland Baker, who's one half of Roland and Heidi Baker, who have a ministry out in Mozambique, extraordinary, miraculous ministry, co-founder of Iris Global with her. So he'll be in conversation with Lucinda van der Hart as well. That's between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Okay, some of your feedback to come still in the programme, but first of all, let's get into the final part of today's discussion on near-death and out-of-body experiences.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding our programme today, we've been hearing the curious case of Eben Alexander, near-death and out-of-body experiences, and we're going to be revisiting this subject again as well in the future. So you can't do justice to something like this in just one programme, really. But we had on the phone with us Jane Aspel of Anglia University. She has been looking into the evidence for near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences and remains sceptical. She just doesn't think the evidence is there to mean we have to go to anything other than a material explanation, a neurological explanation for these things. That's certainly not the view of Eben and Graham, who are still with me on the phone now to just conclude today's programme. Eben, as far as you're concerned, you think that science will have to kind of accept this new paradigm. You think this is kind of almost inevitable, that the information we're getting is overwhelming in this sense?
I would say that is the case. One of the biggest problems here is that materialist science, and I was a big practitioner of pure materialism for the first 54 years of my life until I had my near-death experience. Important to point out that science has absolutely nothing to offer up about a mechanism by which the physical brain might give rise to consciousness. Nobody has the remotest clue. So to pretend that we have, 400 years of the successes of scientific materialism is a real joke. There's nothing there. It's the great white elephant in the room that nobody has the slightest clue how physical matter could create the mind. And really, the reason this is all tough is because we're talking about the mind-body debate that's been going on for 2,600 years.
Yeah.
100 generations of humans have mused over this. And it turns out that what I see is the very clear-cut path forward is that science is going to greatly expand its boundaries to fully accept consciousness as fundamental in the universe, that our soul and spirit is something that is really running this whole show. And the material world is what is illusory.
Do you think that the modern material scientists, you know, I'm thinking of the Dawkins and the Churchills and the Daniel Dennetts and so on. I mean, a lot of the time they speak and write as though the ball is clearly in their court. And people like you, Eben, frankly, are kind of slightly nutty, eccentric types. But for you, it's entirely the other way around, I take it.
It is completely the other way around. And there are many neuroscientists and philosophers and scientists studying quantum physics and the depth of this problem, of the hard problem of consciousness, who realize that our materialist view fails miserably. And that is where I think science is greatly expanding its boundaries. That's why it's very unfair to label this as religion versus science or as natural versus supernatural. It will all be natural in the end because we'll discover more and more about how all of this works. Science can definitely get a lot deeper into this, and it is. That is why I recommend that book, Irreducible Mind, and the sequel to it, Beyond Physicalism, that comes out in February.
Well,
these are very deep thinkers about the nature of all reality, and pure materialism is on the way out. It is doomed. It is so empty of explanation about the phenomena of consciousness that it will be relegated to the dustbin of, oh, the earth is flat, or, oh, the sun goes around the earth. That's the way that pure brain-created consciousness is going.
What I'd want to ask you, though, is obviously, you say, in a sense, we'll expand our category of what counts as natural. We'll obviously, you know, have a much bigger sense of what's going on in the universe. Does any of this, in the end, for you, point to a god? I don't know if that's a concept that you kind of would include
would
in this category.
For me, absolutely. In fact, I would say at the core of our very consciousness, at the core of that mystery of consciousness and how it cannot be reduced to anything in the physical world, that is our most direct evidence that we are linked together through consciousness, not just all humans and not just all life on Earth, but it's far bigger than that. And yes, that there is a divine, benevolent, creative presence and intelligence far beyond anything we could ever imagine that's at the core of it all. That's what so many near-death experiencers come back with. And they can go into it a pure militant atheist and come back from a near-death experience knowing that there's a force of pure love and infinite compassion at the core of this universe. And this, I think it's the blind spot of the materialist, because in science, you know, if you invoke God, then uh-oh, you've broken a rule.
Sure.
And there's the concept of God of the gaps. You know, God is only there to explain the unknown. Well, it's very misleading to believe that we can get, you know, that this God of the gaps idea, that we're close to a theory of everything. I think that's part of what is so wrong about our current science and cosmology. Is the thinking that we're close to understanding everything about the universe. Any sentient being can be tempted into thinking they almost know everything because they almost know everything that they can know. But that doesn't mean that they're close to knowing all of the workings of the universe.
Sure.
The universe has infinite mystery.
Okay, well, it's been really interesting talking to you, Eben. Thank you for being on the program today. And you've obviously recommended the very thick and academic tome, but if you like the layperson's version, The Map of Heaven is your latest book. And really...
Well, The Map of Heaven goes into all this pretty, and I wrote it for the skeptic, I wrote it for the scientist, but I also wrote it for the general person
sure.
of the street. And I think that most people are actually bright enough to get this. And
okay.
by getting being conscious beings, they can do so.
Let's talk to you as well, Graham, before we close out today's program. Does any of this for you point to a supernatural being, a god? Or for you, I think you're quite happy to say, well, at some level it's beyond the kind of reductive materialist kind of atheistic perspective, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we ascribe these things to a deity.
Sure, yeah. I think my perspective would be I tend to try to come at things in a very, like everything, I'm experiencing it for the first time. It's very much about exploring and being open-minded to what the possibilities could be. I guess I like to really look at my experiences. I've definitely had extremely spiritual, transcendent experiences, experiences of oneness, experiences of vast interconnection, experiences of feeling that my consciousness is aware of every living thing. I could in some ways interpret that as something like God or something like an expanded consciousness beyond anything we understand. But I guess I tend to just be cautious about jumping too far to a conclusion about what those things are. The same with the theoretical models about what might be going on. I think in many ways the out-of-body experiences and the near-death experiences in themselves are so fascinating and so transcendent that I'm kind of interested in exploring and sure. learning more about the nature of those experiences. And I've now had hundreds of them through my life. And as I go into those kinds of states, I feel like I get clues, little glimpses of what might be the nature yeah. of an afterlife. Or
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that people like Sam Harris, who, you know, as we know, is a very, if you like, committed materialist, naturalist. All there is really is physical stuff. But he enjoys meditation. He recommends it. I think his latest book is about the benefits of, if you like, undertaking those things, even as an atheist. He would, I'm sure, say, yes, I've experienced a sense of oneness and you know, what you could call an extremely spiritual feelings. But he says you still don't have to go beyond the brain to explain them. They're great. They're very helpful. Do them, meditate and so on. But he's going to turn around to you, surely, Graham, and say, there is an explanation, Graham. You don't have to go down, you know, beyond the realms of the physical world.
Well, Sam Harris is an interesting case, actually, because Sam Harris in, I forget which book it was now, but one of his books actually said that he felt that there was evidence for psi abilities, things like telepathy, etc. And I know that Rupert Sheldrake, the scientist who I've worked quite closely with, had a conversation with Sam Harris where he was much more sympathetic than he might come across in some of his interviews.
Okay.
So in many ways, I think he is open to a certain degree to those kinds of things. But I think when it comes to the idea of a continuation, when there is no brain function or no brain at all, that for him is too far. And I think, you know, that's fair enough to some degree to feel that. But I think the thing for me, when you take it back to the simple fact that when people have these experiences, they can perceive things, they can meet each other, they can have shared experiences out of body. We didn't really get into that very much, but, you know, there's experiences like that as well. How do you really explain that in terms of just some kind of bodily illusion or some kind of hallucination? So even if the brain is fully functioning and, you know, is everything is working in the way it should be working, people are still having these experiences that you can't explain in any normal way. The problem with people like Jane is she spent half of the interview saying that we need this controlled research. And then when you describe the controlled research, she'll simply say, oh, but parapsychology is not controlled enough.
Right. Sure. So it's very difficult to
please.
There's
never anything that's good enough for the skeptics, unfortunately.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Graham. And thank you so much, Eben, for being willing to come on and talk about this. Graham, your books, if people want to check them out, are Avenues of the Human Spirit and Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience. And I'll make sure to post some links to that and where they can find out more about you with today's program online. Same for you, Eben. I'll make sure there are links to The Map of Heaven and where people can find out more about your works as well. That's a premier.
Proof of Heaven.
And Proof of Heaven.
Yeah, they can go to ebenalexander.com.
Ebenalexander.com. Okay, and grahamnichols.com for Graham. Those links and more available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And I'm sure we're going to get lots of response to today's program. So I look forward to hearing that. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. uk, or leave me a comment underneath this program online. We're going to hear some of your experiences and comments, and well, not your out-of-body ones, but at least your thoughts about recent programs that we've had in the last few weeks as well, in just a moment's time. In the meantime, thanks again to Graham and to Eben, and I look forward to perhaps having you on again at some point down the line. I'd like to do a round two, so we'll see what we can set up.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. Great talking with you.
Great.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch. And again, if you want to email in to the show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us online, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, @unbelievablejb, to follow me on Twitter. And of course, all those links and more available from the show website. Okay, let's talk about a couple of weeks ago, we had that really interesting discussion on Christianity on Trial. We had US trial lawyer Mark Lanier, who's written A Defense of Christianity, and former Christian Paul Beaumont interacting with him. Quite a few people picking up on the example that Mark Lanier used at the beginning of the discussion. It's sort of trying to convince Paul of the uniqueness of humans, whether he would eat his grandmother's corpse and that kind of thing. Here's a Jesus Antichristos, who emailed in to say, very interesting and inspiring debate on Unbelievable. Interesting, but regrettably, the debaters can't give the best and wise right answers to the questions. My answer to the question, why humans don't eat the flesh of other human beings, is different. I think that humans don't do that because of some ancient, long-standing social taboo, that humans don't eat other individuals of our own kind, not because of the existence of some god. This taboo protects us humans against the practice of hunting humans and murdering humans for food. So it's just a sort of social taboo that's developed, I suppose, for evolutionary reasons, says Jesus Antichristos. I'm not sure that's your proper name, but that's the one you're going by in your email. The undercover Christian gets in touch to say that he listened to it and thought there was a missed opportunity. It was interesting to hear Paul begin by talking about the gap between Christianity's promise of a relationship with a living God and the experience of many Christians who struggle to feel that they are interacting with a living entity. This would have been a great thing to discuss from an apologetics perspective. For many Christians and ex-Christians I talk to, this gap is a key reason for their draining of their faith. Instead, though, the conversation began with Mark asking Paul whether he'd eat his grandmother. I'm not sure whether that really happened. I may have fallen asleep and dreamed of it, before moving on to talking about some proxies for that issue, the behaviour of Christians, the behaviour of the early martyrs, the credibility of Paul as a witness, and finally the credibility of gospel accounts. As a gentle morning stroll around the garden of apologetics, this was fine, all pretty standard stuff, but the discussion never quite tackled that tantalising issue. Does Christianity really deliver a relationship with God? Perhaps one for another show one day, says the undercover Christian. Yes, I think so. Religious experience is something we've talked about before, but something that tends to get bypassed very often in apologetics. Thank you for that. So let's turn to what we were talking about on last week's programme. And if you were listening to last week's podcast, you will have heard the two debates I aired between Andrew Wilson and Brian McLaren. Andrew, a conservative sort of evangelical perspective on how to read scripture, and Brian McLaren, part of, if you like, the emerging church / progressive movement on this. A number of atheists got in touch to say they actually enjoyed last week's programme, despite it obviously being more of an inter-Christian dialogue. So Derek, for instance, says, even as an atheist, I found the Bible talk on last week's podcast quite interesting. However, at one point, I think Andrew let his mouth run away with him. At around 42 minutes in, he said an awful lot of bad things have been done in the name of Islam and atheism and humanism and goodness knows what else. I wonder if he can give any examples of humanism. I can't think of any. If not, perhaps he should consider taking it back, says Derek. Perhaps in the, you know, the live setting, what he meant was more atheism, Derek. But yeah, humanism, depends. I mean, the concept of humanism as an atheistic concept has not been around for that long. I think humanism was often attributed more to the Christian worldview in the past. And But in any case, it's certainly been sort of co-opted as the ethical brand, if you like, for atheism, hasn't it? Thanks also to, I think it was Michael Brady, who said, the two talks comprising this excellent episode demonstrate what might be done to live Christ-like lives in the modern day if one allows yourself to relax even just a little from a dogmatic, inerrantist interpretation of the Bible. Kudos to all involved. I think you're coming from an atheist perspective on that as well. Ace of Spades said, I was surprised at how respectful this conversation was. Both these comments and these other ones coming actually from underneath the programme on the website where you can listen back to it. Abby said, thanks for airing this. I'm new to the programme. On the topic, I'd like to say that mature Christians should always balance the word of God with the Spirit, who does tell us how to behave in different circumstances of our lives, but will never contradict the written word of God. Goes on to give an example, says, my sister, who was not a Christian, had multiple times sex before marriage and several abortions. She was divorced from her first husband, has a son, and is having endless troubles in her current marriage and is also separated from her husband. For me, I have been married to the same man for 22 years, have 4 children with him. So in my case, God's law protected me and gave me life. Had I listened to my previous boyfriend's interpretation on the intent of this law of sex to be enjoyed within marriage, I would have been in trouble, just like my sister. It's important we know we obey because we love God, not the other way around, says Abby there. And Steve Wilkinson wanted to pick up on some of the things Brian McLaren actually said in this in that debate. He says, why is it that folks like McLaren can't seem to put their views up against informed mainstream Christian orthodoxy, but instead set up straw men out of the most wacky, uninformed goofiness of Christianity? So you're feeling that the examples he gave were straw men. And Michael Dupuy says, the debate basically boiled down to the question of the author. Not authority of scripture, if you get what I mean. Does one read books, for example, the guest books, looking through the filters and lenses of experience, culture, personal beliefs, etc., and then decide meaning? Or does a reader try to understand the author by cutting through the noise in one's head and try to understand what the author meant? In the end, is it the reader or the author who decides what was the intention of the words that were written and the truth therein contained? I think Brian subscribes to the reader being in control of meaning, while Andrew leans towards the author. All right, thanks for your thoughts on those programmes from recent weeks, and hope to hear from you about today's programme as well. In the meantime, I'll say goodbye for now and invite you back again at the same time next week. Coming up next, Lucinda van der Hart in conversation with Tom Herbert and Roland Baker on The Profile between 4 and 5. But at the same time next week here on Unbelievable, we've got a fantastic debate between an atheist and a Christian, two philosophers going at it.
You're unbelievable.
Keith Ward and Michael Roos join me. They joined me last year for a really interesting discussion, and they're back again with their different points of view. And they're going to be covering areas like morality, science, what it would take to convince Michael, a convinced atheist pretty much all his life, that there is a God. So I hope you can join me for that. Same time next week. In the meantime, have a great week. I've been Justin Brierley. Look forward to seeing you again next time.